fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Uncle Nat was listening to that old music on the hi-fi. Left the young Louis Armstrong and everybody sitting around getting high.
Traditionally, opioid addiction was considered a big city problem, and folks who lived in rural America, especially in northern and central Wisconsin, felt they were far removed and immune. But that's no longer the case. Addiction, whether in the form of prescription painkillers or heroin, is a growing problem that is ruining lives and straining the finances of local governments. In Wausau, the number of drug arrests, excluding marijuana, has tripled over the past few years. Marathon County this year will spend more than $2 million to pay for the costs of drug use and enforcement. I'm Glenn Moberg. Today on Route 51, you're going to hear a personal story of opioid addiction and recovery. Mariah Rogowski grew up in Mozenique, started smoking marijuana in eighth grade, later became addicted to prescription painkillers, and soon after was shooting heroin. She's been in recovery for 2.5 years. Her mother, Wendy, has been by her side, helping her through the recovery process, and is now an advocate and an ally for those in similar situations. And also on our panel today, Melissa Moore, the Drug-Free Communities Program Coordinator for Marathon County, and Sheila Weichs, Director of Substance Abuse Services for Marshfield Clinic. We'd like to hear from you as well. Are you alarmed by the growing epidemic of prescription opioid and heroin use and the effects it's having on people in our community? Do you have personal experience with narcotic drugs? Maybe you know somebody who's using them. Maybe you've used them yourself. What do you think the answer is? Do we blame the doctors, the big pharmaceutical companies, or does the blame lay with the users and the dealers? And what about the people who have a legitimate need for prescription opioids because of severe or chronic pain conditions? Should their access also be restricted? You can give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. We've got a great panel with us today, and I want to thank all of you for being with us. Thank you so much. Melissa, why don't we start with you? Tell us about the Drug-Free Communities Program and another local initiative, the AOD, or Alcohol and Other Drugs Partnership.
Sure. Thanks, Glenn, for having us here today. So the Drug-Free Communities Program is actually housed within the health department. My role there is to help lead the prevention efforts in the community. And one of my main focuses and one of my main responsibilities is to work with the Marathon County AOD Partnership, or Alcohol and Other Drugs Partnership. It's a 501c3 local nonprofit initiative. The mission of the group is to lead education, awareness, and prevention efforts to help reduce that burden of substance abuse on the community. So it's really expanded. It's something that I've seen grow beyond just a simple coalition where, you know, there's a lot of great things happening and there's a lot of people reaching out to figure out what they can do next.
You've been working in public health since 2001. Did you see the negative consequences of drug abuse back then? I imagine you did.
Absolutely. You know, when I started, I was just out of college myself. You know, there are things that were in the community, but just not to the extent, you know, that we see now. And really, when it comes to substances of abuse, alcohol by far, you know, this is Wisconsin. Alcohol by far is the number one drug impacting our communities. You know, the more that we look at marijuana as some sort of safe, natural substance, you know, that risk, perceived risk goes down. We've seen increases in that. But just, you know, the rise of opiates linked back to prescription medications, heroin, you know, looking at methamphetamines now and then cocaine as well. You know, these drugs, it's kind of like whack-a-mole. You know, we see ebbs and flows and in trends over the years, and that's something that hasn't changed since 2001. But I would say it's definitely become more complex. And just the prevalence of areas like Marathon County, which sit on the 51-29 corridor, you know, we're just kind of set up for a lot of access to a lot of different drugs.
We're right between the Twin Cities and Green Bay and Milwaukee and Chicago.
Absolutely.
And Madison.
Absolutely. We're definitely a hub for the whole central and northern Wisconsin.
Sheila Wykes, they always said it couldn't happen here. Obviously, they were wrong.
Yes. I've been at this – this is my fourth decade. I'm a tenured addictions professional, I guess I would say. And what I can tell you is that when I started this work, involved in addictions work back in the mid-'80s, for a number of decades, we really didn't see anybody who used IV opiates maybe once a year. And this was with an inpatient unit with many, many people coming from across the state. And when we would see someone, they were inevitably from an urban area that just didn't exist here. Clearly, when it changed as far as pain is the fifth vital sign and this big push that you needed to be pain-free and all of these additional medications came up, out including OxyContin and a number of other meds, that was a huge change, and things changed dramatically. From that point on, not only did we start to see people with opioid use, but we also saw this tremendous, really rapid move from taking pain pills to ending up on heroin. We just never saw that before. Also, a big increase in people injecting. So this has been a huge change. I agree entirely with Melissa that it just didn't look like this back in the early 2000s.
Do you have a typical patient that's suffering from opioid addiction, or do they have some things in common anyway?
Well, generally there are some things in common, whether it is emotional pain or physical pain. You know, opioids work really well to numb things out. So when I mention emotional pain, you know, we talk about the adverse childhood events. There's a real correlation between people having a high number of adverse childhood events and then also being at risk for opioids. If you have a family member who has an addiction issue, there's a genetic predisposition. If you're in situations where there's access, you have increased risk. So when you put all these things together, I mean, it would be really great if this was one of these things that there was a one key issue, and if you addressed that, it would all be okay. This one is so complex and has so many tentacles to it that it's the collaboration and all of these different agencies and people in recovery and families working together that are going to have to address this.
Wendy, you and your daughter, Mariah, are here to tell your personal stories. Why did the two of you feel you needed to appear on the radio show today?
I think it's very important for people to realize that this can happen anywhere and to anybody at any time. And it's so prevalent in our society right now today that we really need to speak out about it and just let people know.
What was life like in your family before Mariah became addicted?
We homeschooled our children for the first many years, and I have four children, and two of my children are actually drug involved. And I thought life was great.
What factors do you think led – well, you've got two children. What factors led both of them to become dabbling with drugs?
In hindsight, now I can look back and see I think it's genetic in our family, both my side and my husband's side. We have a lot of addictive behaviors in individuals. And even though I shielded myself and I thought I shielded my children and my family from that, it's there. It's hereditary. It's genetic. And I can see addictive behaviors in every one of my children.
What was it like for you when you first realized that Mariah had a serious addiction problem?
I'm a problem solver. So my approach was I didn't know what to do, but when I realized I needed to do something, we were gonna do it, we were gonna fix it, and we were gonna move on. That's not the case. Heroin addiction is a lifelong situation. It will always be on the back burner, wanting to boil over, and it always needs to be – you always have to be aware that it's there.
Who did you turn to?
I first turned to our insurance carrier to try to figure out where to go and what to do. My daughter was a minor, and our situation was probably a lot different than some other people who come to addiction at a later age. For us, there was – absolutely nothing available for minors in the state of Wisconsin. Well, that's not true. Libertas in Green Bay was her first treatment.
Well, Mariah, what was your life like before you started using drugs? What was your family life like?
It was great. It was pretty much the ideal thing or ideal life that a child could have or want,
Growing up in a nice, well-kept neighborhood in Mosinee?
We live like way out in the country. My parents, they bought land in between a whole bunch of fields and stuff. Our family owns land out there. So we were able to do a lot of stuff that even a lot of my friends, in town couldn't do. We had everything we needed you know, plus whatever we wanted. We had horses, we had four-wheelers, we had dirt bikes, you know. I got my own puppy for Christmas. It was just, it was, we had everything, you know, everything that we could have wanted.
Why did you start smoking marijuana? You were in eighth grade, right?
Yep. It was, I honestly, it was just kind of, you know, I was out hanging out with my friends. It was just the thing everybody was doing. It was around. It was kind of with the group of friends that I, not even really just a group of friends. I mean, it was pretty much everybody, even the jocks and the preps and everybody in the school,
in
you know.
In eighth grade?
That, well, not, I guess not that that young. There was only, you know, a certain type. But, I mean, I guess I can't even say that because there was a few people that I knew who were on the football team that would, you know, when we left and would go after school, they wouldn't tell some of their other friends, but they would come stop over by, you know, certain people's houses and they would come smoke with us and they would.
I think that surprises a lot of people who are my age. We grew up and familiar with marijuana being something that happened on college campuses or maybe later in high school. But for kids to be getting into it at such a young age is shocking for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, when I look back on it now, I noticed that it was something that, you know, I was very young when I did start it. At the time, obviously, it didn't feel like that. You know, I thought I just had my, you know, my parents had homeschooled me all the way up until then. So it was kind of my first year in, you know, public school. And it was just, to me, it was kind of, I wasn't like the normal thing in my mind, but it was just kind of like, you know,
Why did you do it? How did it make you feel? How did it make you feel with your friends?
At first, for a long time, actually, before I started smoking, I really didn't like it. My brother, actually, I hung out with him and his friends quite a bit because he's 2 years older than me, but he was only a year ahead of me in school. So we had a lot of the same friends and stuff. And when him and his friends first started, you know, it started coming up in their friend group, I didn't like it. I always used to, you know, try and tell my brother, I'd try and tell him I was going to tell on him, or I'd, you know, tell him they were stupid or whatever else. But eventually it was just, you know, it was there so much. It was just something I eventually ended up trying, and I noticed that it wasn't.
So you got turned on to it to a certain extent by somebody you knew who was a little bit older than you.
Yes.
And that's probably what happens with a lot of people. Did you use it at school?
Yeah, a lot of people did. A lot of kids did. A lot of the kids
How do you get away with that?
We would leave. We would just walk out. We would on our lunch breaks, we would just walk out, or we would just skip the first, you know, like the first period or first two periods and just go to either one of our friends' houses that their parents were gone at work, or we would go down, you know, down the road to the skate park or down the road by the park, anywhere, you know. We would just all skip and we would do whatever, and then we would go back, or sometimes we would just skip out in the middle of a class and run to the back. And
Wendy, did you have any idea that your kids were smoking marijuana back then?
I don't think so, not right away, no.
They were pretty good at covering it up.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, me and my brother, we were very... Mm-hmm. We were real good at making sure we knew what we had to do to make sure we kept things under wraps. So.
Probably especially more so than some kids, because I wasn't a parent who was out working. You know, I was home, and there was always somebody home, and there still is to this day always somebody home. I work from home, so either my husband or myself are always there.
Let's get a reaction from our healthcare professionals. Melissa, react to what you just heard Mariah talking about. Eighth grade.
Right, absolutely. You know, one of the things that always shocks me, and I know when you do presentations in the community around drug trends, is that, you know, you ask any sixth grader, they're going to be able to tell you where they can find drugs. You know, it's just a changing landscape. You know, it's not just, you know, finding this stereotypical person standing in the dark alley saying, hey, do you want to get high? I mean, this is stuff that's through social media, through pop culture, you know, within the school, outside of the school, you know, you're constantly in it. You're constantly in that. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't like that term gateway drugs. But when you look at what drugs are highly available in our community, alcohol, tobacco is still one of our leading cause of preventable death. Marijuana and prescription medications, those four are very highly likely to be part of somebody's past.
Well, marijuana is increasingly legal in the United States. Number of states, recreational marijuana, and the federal government hasn't stopped it.
No, and as that perceived risk goes down, you know, the marijuana industry, we call it big marijuana now, I mean, it's taken a page right out of the alcohol and tobacco playbook, you know, putting it out there as a safe, effective way, you know, using lines such as you can overdose from water, but you can't overdose from marijuana. You know, I don't think people fully understand the impact that Colorado is facing, you know, and listening to partners there. You know, I don't think people understand that when you legalize, you know, you're looking at they have twice as many dispensaries now than they do Starbucks and McDonald's combined in Denver. I mean, people do not understand what flooded, what the kind of floods in with the different edibles and the high potency concentrates and, you know, all those things that come with it. You know, I think, you know, marijuana, you know, whether or not there's kids choosing to use, the perception already is that it's everywhere and that it's normal. So that does impact behavior, and there's science that backs it.
Sheila?
I would say I think that's an additional piece. If you think about the neurobiology, not only of addiction, but the neurobiology of brain development, as soon as somebody under the age of 25 is using and using routinely whatever substance they're using, it impacts the wiring of the brain. Because we used to think that, you know, by the time people were 12 or so many years ago, you sort of thought they were just small adults. And there's been a lot of research done where they know that the brains continue to develop until 25 at least. So using in eighth grade, I mean, it rewires your brain. And if you want some examples of that, I mean, because that's the other thing is Colorado's got this legalization, but we don't have longitudinal studies to say what's the impact overall. But I do know I have worked with patients who are 40-something still living in mom's basement, and marijuana has been their major drug of choice, and they just don't necessarily have any need. They're sort of happy down there, and now mom's in her 80s, and it's like, well, he needs to do something. You know, so it does take away the ability to perform at the highest levels, to perhaps go and do those things.
It can take away your ambition.
Absolutely, because you're pretty mellow where you are.
Mariah, you went from marijuana to prescription painkillers and opioids. How did that happen?
It wasn't really anything that I like sought out. It's not like I really went out and looked for it. It was just a lot of, like I said, a lot of my friends were older because either the friends that I had, you know, they had older brothers that were still in school. So we were always hanging out with, when we were freshmen, we were always hanging out with seniors and, you know, people who were a lot older than us. So it was just something that it was just kind of there and offered. It was, you know, at first I never even, I didn't start buying them. It was just something that people would, they were doing it and they'd ask, hey, you want to share a line of this? You want to try this? And
Share a line. So you weren't taking pills. They were grinding them up and in putting them in lines so that you'd snort them?
Yeah. Well, everybody did it different. You know, everybody – some people would parachute them. Some people would snort them.
What do you mean by parachute them?
Parachuting is where, like, you would crush it up and then you take, like, one little thin piece of toilet paper and you put the powder in that and then you just swallow it down and you drink it with some water and it's supposed to kick in a lot sooner than, you know
– Because
if you
it's ground up.
Yeah, if you would just orally take it, but –
Did you have any straight friends at the time?
A few, yeah. There was a couple people that I hung out with and I knew that they didn't do anything along the lines of that.
What leads kids to using painkillers and other drugs? Is it insecurity? Does it help you break down barriers so that you can relate to other people better? Form a group?
I think it has to do with a lot of different things. It could have to do with just that person personally. They might be, you know, dealing with something in, you know, just themselves, especially at that young of an age. Everybody's trying to figure out, you know, who they are, what they, you know, where they fit in, things like that. So it's just kind of, I think it's different for everybody. It might be different factors for a lot of people or factor, you know, a little bit of each, something from each that just kind of combines that does it.
Wendy,
I think one other thing with that is the piece where, and you're exactly on target, where different people react differently. Because of the genetic differences and the receptors in the brain, there are some people, I've had them tell me when they're working on recovery that they took that first opioid and it was like a key in a lock. They were energized. Now, in the general population, you give them an opioid, it's a depressant and it, you know, they'll make them sleepy, they don't feel pain, et cetera. There are some people who it actually energizes them because they actually take it in and respond to it differently. Those folks, of course, are at much higher risk than people for that it makes them sleepy.
Thanks. Thanks, Sheila. And Wendy, your kids grew up in the country. They were homeschooled. Do you think sheltering them like that might have made it difficult for them to relate to other people when they got into the public school system?
No, because I think that's a fallacy when you say that we sheltered them or that they were sheltered. Our children had more experiences than any school child ever had. However, I do believe that because of the general thought process like that, they even felt that they were sheltered. And that is one of the reasons, in my opinion, why they went out and did that. And another reason was that the drug community is a very welcoming community. For my kids to have gone into school at the 7th and 8th grade levels, the group that welcomed them in without any reserve was the group of kids that was involved in that kind of a situation.
And it wasn't too long after you started taking pills, according to what I've been told, Mariah, that you started shooting heroin. How do you make that transition?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely wasn't right away, but it wasn't too far down the road from when I started using. But it was just kind of, for me, it was a lot of the people that, you know, the more I started using and realizing I liked using pills, and the more I started, you know, going and looking for them myself after people weren't, you know, always just offering them, that was the more that I started to meet, you know, even older people and people who had been using even longer. And it was something that, I mean, there was a lot of people, I didn't even really realize it at the time, but a lot of people did it that I didn't even realize that did it. They did, you know, and it was just,
you know,
it was introduced.
I grew up in the 70s and was exposed to the drug culture, but there was always like a line between the people who used needles and shot up and the people who didn't.
I used to say the same thing all the time. I used to say, I'm never, you know, to me in the beginning, it was, like you said, there was a very big line. It was, you know, people who just pop pills. They could have been doing the same thing. They could have been using heroin but just snorting it. But if they were, you know, shooting it up, it was something completely different in my eyes, even though they were using the same exact drug.
What were the circumstances when you first put a needle in your arm? Where were you and how did that happen?
The very first time was when I was in Marshfield, and I was hanging out with some people, and we were all, there was a whole bunch of people, you know, we were all pitching in money to get stuff, and I had to, some people wanted some other stuff, they wanted some weed, so me and somebody else, I left my money there with some people, and me and somebody else had left to, you know, go pick up some other stuff, and by the time I came back, they had already had everything, and they kind of all put everything together, and they just melted it down and, you know, put everything in syringes because that's how everybody there did it. And they kind of just told me, you know, I already spent my money on it, and by that time I already, you know, I wanted it. I was going and looking for it. So they kind of told me it was either you can do it like this or someone else is going to do it and you're going to have to buy some more. And I just
What did it feel like the first time you did that? What did you experience?
To me, it just kind of it all made sense right away when I did it the first time. It all made sense on, you know, why people do it, because it wasn't as bad. You know, I thought it was gonna hurt. I didn't think it was gonna be, you know, anything what it was. And to me, it just,
was there an incredible rush that came with it that was different than?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, it goes instantly right into your bloodstream, and it goes right, you know, it hits you right away. So it's like the kind of the best way to describe it is kind of like just like somebody, you know, coming and giving you just like a really big warm hug. You can just feel, you know, it just rushes all through your body, and it's warm. It I don't know. It just kind of takes over. It makes you.
Weren't you afraid of overdosing, of killing yourself?
In the very beginning, when I did start using, when I started using IV, it was, you know, I did think about it. And I remember at first I was like super paranoid. I had been told that if there's air bubbles when you, you know, when you're shooting up, and if there's air bubbles in the syringe, that you can die from that. And that was something that I kind of freaked out about at first. And that was something that I was very, for a long time, like I would sit there and try and make sure that I didn't have any air bubbles in there, and it was just a big mess. But after a while, I just kind of, it didn't matter. That wasn't something that really, I mean, I knew it was a very big possibility, but at the time it didn't matter.
Wendy, You're her mother. How do you feel hearing her talk about it like this?
It's hard to hear that. You try to shield your kids from that. And, of course, we talked about it. And because we didn't have the kids, with people that were in those types of situations, I just assumed that that wasn't ever going to be anything that was a part of our lives. It's hard to hear that. But we've been going through it for quite a long time. And I guess, some days I'm a basket case and some days I'm stronger. And so it, I guess, depends on the day sometimes.
Today on Route 51, we're looking at the opioid crisis in north central Wisconsin from a personal perspective with our guests, Mariah and Wendy Rogowski, and Melissa Moore, the Drug-Free Communities Program Coordinator for Marathon County. Also, Sheila Weix, she's the Director of Substance Abuse Services for the Marshfield Clinic. I'm Glenn Moberg. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the long road to recovery. Here's Joni Mitchell with a song about heroin.
Concrete concentration camp. Bashing in veins for peace. Hopeless streets we fall. Fall into lady release. Come with me. I know the way. She says it's down, down, down the dark ladder.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Five Nines, Ashland County Tourism, and Festival Foods. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. Go to WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Attorneys Sturgill and Long, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and the Michigan Upper Peninsula. Information is at 888-613-0600.
I was just writing the experience I'd had of withdrawing from heroin. And saying, this is what I thought when I was withdrawing.
My feet are so heavy. So is my head. I wish I was a baby. I wish you was dead. Old Turkey.
John Lennon with a song that he wrote from personal experience, taking us into our next segment of Route 51 as we discuss the opioid crisis in north central Wisconsin with our guests, Mariah and Wendy Rogowski and Melissa Moore, the Drug-Free Communities Program Coordinator for Marathon County, and Sheila Weix, Director of Substance Abuse Services for Marshfield Clinic. I'm Glenn Moberg. If you'd like to join the conversation, here's the phone number, 1-800-780-9742. 1-800-780-9742, or you can put a comment on our website, wpr.org/route51, and I'll read it on the air. Melissa Moore, your reaction to what you heard in the last segment, the transition that Mariah made from marijuana to opioids to shooting heroin.
I think Mariah did a really great job. I'm really proud of her for her sharing her story, because I think by sharing her story, I think it really does help to, bring people out from the shadows. Her and Wendy working together on this, I think too many people think they're alone in this fight. When somebody is using, it is a very welcoming community. But then when it comes to, okay, I'm ready to start down that path to recovery, you find yourself quickly alone. You got to relearn everything that you've done. So I think the pressure to stay in it, it is great. So I think, that window that Mariah was talking about from someone starting using and maybe starting an experiment. For some people, it is instant. For some people, it takes a little bit of practice. But, whatever keeps them going, that window of finding something bigger, better, faster, stronger, is going to continue. And that's just, that nature of addiction. So, I think that, like I said, for not everybody's going to become addicted. You can have five people in a room. One person might. The other four might not. But I think it's whatever it is, addiction is person specific, and so is that road to recovery.
Well, it's hard for me to imagine somebody shooting heroin and not being addicted to it.
I've talked to plenty of folks where, their experimentation with opiates starts with legitimate use. It could be a oral surgery. It could be a sports injury. Just imagine you're a 16-year-old kid, has a season-ending injury. Your life was football. And they give you this medication that makes you feel good. And then you realize when you take a little bit more, it makes you feel even better. And it's not hard to believe that somebody's going to go from spending $80 per pill for OxyContin and going into heroin where you could get a high, if you will, for $10. I mean, who's not going to continue to not only get that high, but, you know, when it comes to opiates, that withdrawal is so severe, you know, like the worst flu you've ever felt, you get to the point where you're using because you want to avoid that withdrawal. And that high, that joy of that high just isn't there.
Let's go to Wayne in Park Falls, who's been waiting patiently. Wayne, you're on Route 51.
Yes. I'm a guardian for a granddaughter, and she had 3 surgeries this summer. And the first surgery was most serious, caused her the most pain, and the doctor gave her 8 oxycodone. And she ended up using 2. Her mother had an opiate problem with shooting up and all that, and she didn't want anything to do with it. Then she had 2 more surgeries, and the second surgery, the doctor wanted to give her 15 more oxycodone. And I says, we still got some at home. I says, can't we cut that in half? Well, you can do it at the drugstore, they told me, which I did. And then she didn't use any. Then the third surgery, they wanted to give her more. And I said, if we need any, we'll call you. But I think the doctors are overprescribing. And
Wayne, we got it. Thanks so much. I want to give our guests here a chance to respond. Sheila, you work for the Marshfield Clinic. Are the doctors overprescribing?
Well, there's actually a couple of things. First of all, I would like to say kudos to you as the guardian. That's actually one of the best protections for minors is their guardians and parents saying, hold it, no, I don't want that prescription. Or if there's going to be a prescription, I only want 3. Let's see if we need more. So kudos to you, sir. That's the best thing you could possibly have done. In terms of prescribing, that process is changing. I have to tell you, not too long ago, there would probably have been 30 of those opioid medications on that first surgery. So there's actually a big reduction going on. Within the Marshfield Clinic Health System, there is actually a director of controlled substances, and there is some major work going on to decrease the prescribing, but then also to come up with alternatives. Because your other problem is, if someone's going to have surgery, what are your other recommendations? And really looking at things other than opioids. Because remember, we've got a lot of advertising out there, and we've kind of created the expectation among patients that I'm going to be pain-free for many, many people. So we're working on it, but there has been major reductions across the system as a result of what they're undertaking. There's also some state things going on with what we call the PDMP that registers medication so that the physician, if this patient was to go to the ER, the ER physician could look and see how many medications they'd gotten from what provider prior to coming to the ER. Before this, that didn't really exist. So physicians were kind of having to prescribe in the dark. So there's some things going on. Progress is being made. There's a ways to go.
You know, and then when you look at a federal level, the CDC came out with their recommendations about a year and a half ago now. And then the state came out with their own recommendations, which actually went a little bit higher. And there's greater expectations for those that are looking to prescribe. So I think that there are a lot of steps taken. And when we've done our local assessments here, looking at where do people perceive people that are looking to abuse medications are getting them from, 3 out of 4 people say they feel they're getting it from family members or friends, whether they're stealing them or giving them. You know, prescribers are one piece of it, but we really got to look at how many of those medications are we keeping in the home, how many medications that are expired or unwanted or unused. You know, use those prescription drop boxes. I'm pretty confident that every single county has access to a drop box location. You know, look at the Department of Justice site. You can find locations near you. Marathon County has 6. We're actually looking to add a 7th right away in the new year. So, you know, this is something that is available. And the gentleman who called, please contact your local law enforcement. Find where you can get those medications out of your home. As you said, you don't need them. There's no reason to keep a hold of them.
Wendy?
And when you have them in your home, you will hear people talk about lock boxes. I would highly, highly recommend a lock box in your home. If you have any narcotic medications, keep them there and, you know, just keep it under lock and key.
Mm-hmm. Mariah,
also suggest elderly relatives. One of the big places for pain meds to be picked up is by elderly relatives. Go to visit grandma. And They don't have any awareness of this need. They're at risk, too, a whole different conversation. But as far as keeping it out of the hands of people it wasn't prescribed for, that's a big one.
Thanks, Sheila. Mm-hmm. I want to get back to your personal story, Mariah. What was it like to withdraw from heroin?
Pretty much felt like you're dying. I mean, you feel like, you know, people say that, like, it's like one of the worst flus that you can, you know, like, but to me, it's like the worst flu that I've had times 30, you know. It feels like, everything in your body, it just aches in it. And then on top of that, the mental part, on top of the physical part, the mental part, you know, you think, you know, in your brain, you're telling, you know, your brain's telling your body you're not going to feel better unless you get this to feel better. So it just...
How did you get through it?
I did it a couple different times. There's a couple different times where my parents, you know, they wouldn't let me leave the house. I had to sit there and I stayed up in my room, you know, and I did it like that because I wasn't able to leave the house. There was times when I had to do it, you know, I remember a couple specific times where I tried to do it on my own for, you know, a few days, and I just tried to, you know, lock yourself away and not, you know, sit in your room and not try and make yourself as comfortable. You know, I remember nights where I would literally sleep in the bottom of the shower because that was the only way I could, you know, to run the warm water or the cold water on my body was the only way I could just sit still.
How long did it take for you to get over the bad part?
It takes about, for me, it would take about 5 to 7 days, somewhere around there.
It's a long time to be in the worst pain that you've ever experienced in your life.
Yeah, and, you know, and it's not like you can just sleep through it either. You can't, you know, you can't fall asleep or anything like that. So it's, you have to sit up and you have to deal with it all.
Wendy, it must have been devastating for you as her mother watching this happen.
It is one of the hardest things to have to go through, and I'm sure any parent of or loved one of an addicted, you know, heroin addict, to watch them detox is extremely difficult. And, you know, it doesn't happen just once. It happens over and over and over again through the course of her using. I can't count on my hands how many times, you know, we watched her try to go through that.
Well, Mariah, you've been clean for over 2 years now?
Yeah, it's
a... Congratulations.
About 3 years or so.
And how did you get through it? What were the resources that were brought to bear in your case that made a difference for you?
A lot. I mean, there was a lot. Yeah, there was a lot of stuff. I mean, I went through a couple different inpatient treatments, and even though I wasn't able to stay clean from those, I was able to take, you know, each treatment that I went to, I was able to take different information from, you know, each one and take that. And it was, and after a while, I was able to get into the methadone program. And that's, you know, it's definitely something that it took a while. Especially once I got into the methadone program, I didn't get clean right away. It was back and forth for a little while, but it's definitely been something that's helped me quite a bit.
Wendy, comment on this. What you helped her through the process. What do you think made a difference as her mother watching it from someone's perspective who loves her dearly?
There is a big controversy on medication-assisted treatment. It's becoming more accepted now, but in our opinion, in our family, and what happened and worked with her and a couple of other people, medication-assisted treatment really made the difference for her. She was able to function. She is able to think straight and not be focusing on the cravings.
Is that methadone? Is that what you're...
Methadone for her. For other people, there's Suboxone, right. There's Vivitrol, there's other things.
Right. Sheila?
Yep. I say, if I can speak to that. We do provide medication-assisted treatment in the Marshfield Clinic Health System. We have a center up in Minocqua where it's currently happening. We will be bringing it to Marshfield, but I am right on the same line with you. It's an important piece because we actually, when you're doing the buprenorphine, we do not do methadone. That's a separate type of clinic and license. But we do the buprenorphine products. And the thing with that, when you described your withdrawal, what we do is we have a person not use in the past 24 hours, so they're in mild to moderate withdrawal. The buprenorphine stops the withdrawal, and we titrate it. And what's the really nice piece with that is by the time the person leaves that day, we see them for 3 days in a row when we're doing that. It's an outpatient procedure. But when the person leaves, they're able to keep food down. They're not feeling as miserable. And because we know that the buprenorphine, while it ties up the mu receptors in the brain, which is the craving piece, it also works with the stress regulatory response. So you can think and function. You had mentioned that with the methadone. So it makes a huge difference for people.
It does, but I do believe that, and I have seen it, you know, and I'm sure that there's, you know, science to back it as well. It really depends on the individual what type of medication is going to work for them.
Oh,
like
absolutely.
You said before, there are different ways that people respond. Their chemistry makeup in their body is different. And methadone is a tried and true treatment, and it has been used for a long time, as well as, you know, buprenorphine and I don't know what is it naloxone for the Vivitrol?
Right.
But also the individual's length and type of use, you know, how long they've been using and how much they've been using, I think really plays into that as well.
It can, but the other piece, when we've really gone to looking at it, instead of being MAT, we call it TAM, treatment assisted by medication.
Okay.
So what we involve with this is really intensive treatment, because the medication's just to stabilize you so you can think and function and you're not looking for that next fix. Then we work from there. And that's a huge piece, whether it's methadone or buprenorphine or Vivitrol. You've got to have the treatment aspect.
The age of the individual, though, has to be addressed. I don't know what the legal age right now is to be able to use it. However, when Mariah was a minor, it was not legal for her to use any of those medication-assisted treatments. So
Correct.
We went through a long period of time where I was actually told by somebody in an AODA unit, which I won't name, but she was 16 at the time, and essentially what I was told was she can walk the streets and shoot herself up for 2 years, and then when she's 18, she can knock on our door and we can help her.
Today on Route 51, we're looking at the opioid crisis in north central Wisconsin from a personal perspective with our guests Mariah and Wendy Rogowski, Melissa Moore, the drug-free coordinator for Marathon County, and also Sheila Weichs, the director of substance abuse services for Marshfield Clinic. I'm Glenn Moberg. We're going to take a short break. Here's Neil Young.
I've seen the needle and the damage done, a little part of it in everyone, but every junkie's like a setting sun.
Support for WPR comes from the state of Wisconsin, the federal government, businesses, and the single largest piece of the budget comes from the 50,000 individuals and families who make contributions. Thank you to everyone who makes WPR possible.
Support also comes from the Central Wisconsin Symphony Orchestra, presenting Home for the Holidays, December 2nd and 3rd at Century's Theater at 1800, featuring special guest artist Danny Mitchell. More at cwso.org.
But the morphine eased the pain, and the grass grew around his brain, and gave him all confidence he lacked. With a purple heart and a monkey on his back, there's a hole in daddy's arm where all the money goes.
John Prine with his song Sam Stone, about a veteran with post-traumatic stress disorder, taking us into our next segment of Route 51 as we talk about the opioid crisis with Mariah and Wendy Rogowski, Melissa Moore, the Drug-Free Communities Program Coordinator for Marathon County, and Sheila Weichs, the Director of Substance Abuse Services for Marshfield Clinic. I'm Glenn Moberg. We're going to go back to the phones. We have Janet in Waukesha. Janet, you're on Route 51.
I have a quick question. They talk a lot about addiction being hereditary. I am just wondering if there are other addicts in the family, whether it's cousins, siblings, things like that, and how that family dynamic now can work if some are still using, some aren't, that sort of thing.
Wendy?
That is a very, very difficult situation, because each and every recoveree needs to know how strong they are and where they are in their recovery and, you know, who they can be with and who they have to stay away from.
Sheila?
So part of that's about developing that recovery support system, whoever that is for you. Some people come up with different families, and they prepare. Interestingly enough, we're talking about the holidays coming up now. Some people need to prepare to go spend time with their bio family, and that's an okay thing, and some can't go do that. Depends on where they're at with recovery and what their supports are.
Melissa, the drug problem in Marathon County is going to cost government more than $2 million this year alone. And some 28 Wisconsin counties have now joined federal lawsuits that claim nefarious and deceptive marketing campaigns from pharmaceutical companies being responsible for the epidemic. Do you think holding pharmaceutical companies responsible will help combat this in any way, shape, or form?
You know, I think that there's definitely an importance of having some product stewardship here because, you know, while pharmaceutical companies are not necessarily the main cause of the issue, I think it's important to recognize that they are need to be part of the solution. And there's a lot of money there. They're making money off of people's use and people's addictions. And, you know, I think it's important that it is part of that. And you know, I believe Marathon County is one of those counties that has joined in to that lawsuit. And, you know, looking at it similar to the tobacco companies where there's a harm that's known and there's not enough done to be able to prevent it.
And there's also been reports of police and paramedics coming in contact with fentanyl, which is 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine. The contact itself can lead to accidental overdoses. You work for Marathon County. Are safety precautions being taken to protect our public service officers?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a lot of guidelines that have come out through the DEA and DOJ to protect our first responders, right down to the canine units. You know, our dogs are at the potential for overdosing. And that fentanyl is so dangerous. I think a lot of people still think back to fentanyl patches that were used for long-term pain management or post-cancer surgeries and so on. But this fentanyl that's coming in is not necessarily legitimately prescribed. It's synthetics that are being shipped in from overseas, primarily China. It is something that is available. And, you know, using naloxone or Narcan, where it may take one or two doses to bring someone back if they're overdosing on heroin, for example, you know, five doses may not be enough. So it is scary. I know a lot of policies and procedures have changed. And, you know, when you look at something like getting your kids involved in a highway cleanup, you know, what risk could they be at? You know, there's just a lot of discussions and a lot of things that people just – we need to talk about it. We need to not pretend it's their problem, it's our problem, and just really look at how do we build those communities supportive of recovery and how do we you know, prevent this from happening to next generations.
Well, we're down to our last couple of minutes. Sheila, give me 30 seconds that we haven't covered here that you think we need to talk about.
I would say probably the thing that really comes to mind, but it's come up in a couple of different ways. There's no one solution to this. There's no easy solutions. It's about collaboration among everybody, among the families, the counties, the providers, legal, I mean, everyone. One example of that, just as a sidelight, is the Marshfield Clinic Health System has just joined the Hazelden Betty Ford Patient Care Network. That announcement's coming out today, and part of that's joining together with providers across the country for research, tools, and to figure out what works. Because we know in urban areas, things may be different than they are in rural, and we've got to figure out what's going to work for everybody.
Mariah, if somebody is listening who's where you were a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, what can you tell them? What possible advice can you give them as somebody who's gone through it that might make a difference?
I would just say that I know it to a lot of people it feels like it's not possible. Like it's just so far out of reach. It's just not, you know, not possible. Either they've been using for years and years and years and they just – or – there's a lot of different things, and it's just – I would just say don't give up. It takes a long time. It takes a long, long, long time.
Wendy, you've got the last word. You've got 10 seconds.
Parents, just know where your children are and what they're doing and who they're with as often and at all times.
I'll be all right. I'll be all right. I'll be all right someday. Deep in my heart, I do believe I'll be all right someday.
We want to thank today's guests, Mariah and Wendy Rogowski, Melissa Moore, Drug-Free Communities Program Coordinator for the Marathon County Health Department, and Sheila Weix, Director of Substance Abuse Services for Marshfield Clinic. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our show producer and on-air producer, Jana Schleiss. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground, Garland Jeffries, Joni Mitchell, John Prine, Neil Young, John Lennon and the Plastic Ono Band, and Jorma Kekkonen. Next week on Route 51, we focus on national, state, and local politics, and there is a lot to talk about with views from the left and the right side of the political spectrum. And if you missed part of the show, you can hear it again Friday evening at 7 on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. You can download it at wpr.org/route51. Thanks again for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. And until next week, we're heading out of town.
If trouble comes, I don't pay no mind. Be all right someday. Deep in my